Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's now possible to step back in time on Broadway to the 16th century, where the intrigues of Henry VIII's court are in full display thanks to the Royal Shakespeare Company's masterful production of Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2. And I'm pleased that its three leads are with us now: Ben Miles, who stars as Thomas Cromwell, Nathaniel Parker, who plays King Henry VIII, and Lydia Leonard, who is his queen-to-be, Anne Boleyn. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank
you. Had you all read Hilary Mantel's Booker-winning novels on which the stage production is based before there was talk about adapting them into the plays?
I was reading Wolf Hall, funnily enough, when I got the call about the offer to play Thomas Cromwell for the RSC. So it was sort of nicely coincidental.
So, Ben, did you think of Cromwell as a character you might play if it was ever adapted?
I had no real idea. I mean, I knew about the RSC project. I knew that was happening. I knew that the BBC project was sort of nascent at the time. I don't think there was a director attached to that at that point. So I knew that there were, you know, dramatic versions of it being planned.
And Lydia?
No, I hadn't. No, I read them when I got offered the part.
So what was it like reading the novels when you had your part in mind?
Very, very exciting. Because I was sort of forced to read them relatively quickly and both in quick succession before we started rehearsals, rather like coming to see both shows in a day when you come to see our plays. So thoroughly enjoyed them and just, yeah, I hadn't taken on board quite how brilliant they were and, of course, how popular they were. So knowing that I was going to play the part and reading them was thrilling.
And Nathaniel, it must be...
For me, it was...
You're playing Henry VIII.
I'm playing Henry VIII. But for me, I just got through to about page 100 and started to put it down. I was so confused with the pronoun problem I had with it initially. And then, having been offered it, I went, you know, I better read these. So I went through them and found they were two of the best books I've ever read.
Do you tend to do other kinds of research as well when you're preparing for...
Yeah, no, of course, because you're just so interested in the period, personally. I read a couple of other books specifically on Anne. But then sometimes it's not helpful because you're bringing up in all this other information when actually the Anne that I play is Hilary's Anne and a cog in our story of Wolf Hall. So.
Well, you mentioned that it's Hilary's Anne because all of you, I'm sure, have studied this period during your school days, and you probably formed ideas about the characters you're playing. And are they at all like the ones playing?
As Henry, no. And I think that's part of the joy for me is that I've had all the preconceptions, which apart from the school years, you get the various films that have been made over the years of the line I use is the chicken bone sucking, thigh slapping, wench grabbing Henry, and a murderous Henry, and it's not like that for me. All the research I needed to do was in the scripts. I read the books, I put them down, and that was it for the books. Everything else, I just thought I'd do off the page. I know Ben has a different attitude to it because he's still reading the books.
Yeah, no, I have finished them, I must say.
You've said that you're still investigating the character,
I'm a slow
Ben.
Reader.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Is that because Cromwell is a mystery to the people who had to deal with him during his own lifetime?
I think he is a mystery. I think he is he's an enigma. I think that's largely the reason for his popularity and the draw of these stories and these plays, I think, is... It's an attempt to understand a character about which very little is known, but his influence has been so great. So, I'm rereading the books in terms of I'm constantly trying to fathom the guy. I still am. I still haven't completely worked out why he does what he does. You know, my opinions sort of change.
History has treated him as a villain.
Exactly. Yeah, and these books, interestingly enough, I think have rewritten history. But the mad thing is that they're not historic works. They're novels. It's fiction, but it's become sort of slowly, subtly these books have become the books on the period.
And they give us a very different Thomas More than the one we met in A Man for All Seasons.
They're brilliant researched novels, though. I mean, they are as thoroughly researched as any piece has ever been written on it.
By saying it's fiction, I don't mean it's... Well, fiction. Yeah. It's made up. But Hillary said Cromwell, the character of Cromwell is he's a biographer's nightmare but a novelist's dream. You know, there's only so much known about him and the rest... Hillary has, you know, she's filled in the gaps.
And she's written it actually largely through his mind. Yeah. So are you surprised by how effective as theater these plays have turned out to be? Because you don't have voiceover here.
Yeah, I am in some way. And a testament to our brilliant director and to everyone involved that it's, we've really lifted it off the page. But kind of Cromwell's this sort of central character, and then there's all these other characters whirling around him that whisk on and off, and the action is really fluid, isn't it, around him?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there was a point in the sort of script development process where voiceovers and soliloquies were mentioned.
It would have made it more Shakespearean.
Shakespearean. Yes, but I think it would have slowed the pace up of the plays, and the danger we faced when dramatizing these plays was pace, and was the need to keep the audience's attention for 2.5 hours.
I think the big debate also in England, wasn't it, with the press, particularly the literary press, saying this can't possibly be made into a play. It just won't happen, you know. There's no way they can lift it enough or condense it enough. 170-odd characters or something, I think, in the books. But
and 20 actors.
We have. Yeah. Yeah. And we've done it in a spectacular style, though, I might say so. I mean, I think Jeremy Herrin has really evolved the 23 of us, 22 of us, onto that stage and brought all the characters forth, I think.
Now, Lydia, Anne Boleyn only appears once in the first hour of part one and only has a sentence of dialogue, "Do you know me?" And yet that sentence speaks volumes. Mm. And then, of course, she takes on a very powerful role in the second hour.
Yeah. I think as Jeremy was saying, not to make that "do you not know me" too domestic. It's one of speaking to history, really announcing herself. Because there's so much kind of... It's a very pertinent question. We don't know much about Anne Boleyn. So much information was destroyed by Henry and after she was killed.
Don't take it personally.
Well, she's a subject... object of so much... gossip.
Yeah.
She may not even be on the stage, but she's on the stage. So when you come out there, you have to personify this character that everybody else has been discussing.
Yeah. No, in many ways, it's quite easy. You get a lot of the kind of work done for you by everyone else before you arrive.
I'm stood in the audience at that point, so watching the action, and there's a fantastic reaction to that line. I don't know if you can feel it from where you are, but often... when you say, "Do you not know me?" That most of the Winter Garden Theatre goes, "Oh yeah, we know."
Well, we also know this fantastic history. We may not know all the details, but even in this country, we know most of the history of Henry VIII because he is one of the most important.
He's the most famous
monarchs
king
England ever
the
had.
The most famous king anywhere, isn't he? I mean, is there a more famous king? Possibly from the Bible, but I don't know.
I don't know. Herman's Hermit's
Also, became... there's another wonderful moment for Anne, which Lydia plays so brilliantly, that when we've got the court scene towards the end of the second half, and she's saying just where Elizabeth's place is in the hierarchy compared to Mary, my first daughter. And I see the audience, because I'm allowed to look out in the audience as much as I like, really, as Henry. And I see the audience, there's so many women just going, "Yeah, you tell them, you tell them." And it's always a lovely, rather than lifting, please.
I'm speaking with Nathaniel Parker, who plays King Henry VIII, Lydia Leonard, who plays Anne Boleyn, and Ben Miles, who plays Thomas Cromwell, in the Royal Shakespeare production of Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2. Parts 1 and 2 because... together, and they are being performed together sometimes.
Yes, they are.
Every Saturday and Sunday.
And Wednesdays.
Mostly Wednesdays, yes. Every other Wednesday we do that. Sometimes we flip them around and we do the part two first so that people can come to a matinee of that if they need to.
And it's at the Winter Garden Theatre on Broadway. As Henry VIII, your interactions with Cromwell are colored by the fact that he was quite devoted to Cardinal Wolsey, who... Yeah. And Henry has decided to demote, or whatever word we want to use, the cardinal.
Yes, I think, interestingly, Henry has his first main advisor in life is Wolsey, who was a butcher's son. and has risen through the ranks to get there. And
people keep on pointing out that he was.
Yes. Well, the hierarchy, the nobility do,
and Cromwell's do. Background as well is and constantly then, thrown in his face.
And then, as his demise starts to happen, Wolsey says, "Go and stand in." Well, actually, I think it's your assistant says, "Go and stand in Henry's light." And so he does. He stands in my light, and suddenly this man, who's a blacksmith's and publican's son, becomes my closest friend and the most powerful man in England after me. Probably before me, actually, at some points.
But Henry had to make that transition. He associates Cromwell with Wolsey.
I think that's why he gives him the light. He's been bullied, I think, by the nobility to get Wolsey out. His big problem is an heir. And Catherine hasn't supplied him with an heir after six children. He only has a daughter. So what he needs now is a son. And the way to get that is to divorce Catherine. But being the emperor of Spain's aunt, that's right, and also a Catholic.
And the emperor of Spain was the most powerful monarch in Europe
at the time. And also the Pope. He has to divorce himself from that. And doing that is very tricky. And unfortunately, Wolsey doesn't quite get there. So Cromwell steps in, saves the day for him.
Do you see Henry, who we normally think of as this very powerful, willful king, as somebody who can be manipulated?
Well, I see him in this as Hillary's version of Cromwell's version of Henry. And I think as a result, it's given me a completely different Henry to play. One of the lovely things I've heard from people when they come backstage after the show is, "That was a surprise. That's not what I expected." And it's given me an absolutely... There's a line from Wolsey in the first half which says he believes everything he says as he says it, which is a gift.
It allows
me to play every single line and every single scene, and which is why later on, when he's much more in my favour, Cromwell's much more in my favour, he says you can never quite tell with Henry where he's going to be. 2 hours he's going to attack you, and the next 2 hours he's going to love you. And I think that gives me as an actor such wonderful freedom.
Ben, how does Cromwell view Anne? As the way into Henry, or do you think he connects to her in some other ways?
I'm not sure he sees her as a way into Henry. He and Anne are quite similar in many ways, in that we're sort of outsiders to the established royal court of England at the time, even though Anne is a daughter of a gentleman who has been raised in status because of his other daughter's association with Henry. His other daughter, Mary Boleyn, is one of Henry's mistresses.
And that was, may have been.
I think you'll find it's true.
Everybody is claiming to be chaste in this play.
No, don't believe that for a minute. So they're both coming in from the outside, and they're also both people who are, to put it crudely, on the make, you could argue. They have an agenda, each of them, and they are very strong-willed, I think, and they are both able to manipulate situations and people to their advantage. And I think Cromwell, for all the antipathy that you see between them, there's also a kind of a deep-held respect and admiration for Anne from Cromwell, because he knows what it takes to get where she's got, you know. And he knows that, you know, she's a very intelligent, driven woman. And I think he admires that in people, intelligence and ambition.
Lydia, Ben just said that Anne is strong-willed. She does have to contend with a lot of rumors about her past. Mm-hmm. But some people have described her as a proto-feminist. Do you see that?
Well, I think actually Hillary put it good. Hillary said that she's not a feminist. She's just a very, very powerful woman. So she doesn't know. Because she could be a proto-feminist, but she's certainly not a woman lover. She is surviving in a very difficult time to be a woman. But she mainly plays. She's got to play in a man's world, and she's a survivor. So I don't think she's certainly not doing. It's self-serving.
And it was a rough time to be a woman. I have read that Queen Elizabeth was not allowed to attend the first Privy Council meeting after she had taken the throne because she was a woman, and that had to be changed. Does Anne see Cromwell as a means to accomplish her own ends, to marry the king?
I think she sees, as Ben was saying, they see something in each other that they can both use. So they're both useful to each other in their scent. And it's really, not to be kind of glossed over, how, what an extraordinary scent it is for Cromwell to get to where he does in our story. And for Anne, you know, she was just a gentlewoman's daughter. So it seems like this is a normal thing. It was completely unheard of to get so high up in the king's favour for two people of their origins.
You've said that you don't want to fall into the trap of making her likeable.
No, well, it's quite difficult to, I think, but...
to make her likeable?
I don't think it's really... No, it's not... I don't think it's necessary for the... She doesn't try to make herself likeable, so...
Well, she still has to do things to keep the king wanting her.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but you don't see those on stage.
You don't see that, unfortunately, do we? I think one of the traits they had in common is that they both learn all the time. From scene to scene, they've learned how to deal with the previous problem, and they go on to do that. And they prey on Henry's naivety. It has to be said, I think they do. But they both learn. So once he likes that, well, I know how to keep him there. Mm-hmm. And then I can step up there, and then we can keep him there. Cromwell gives me that little bit more power all the time. Let the lion know his strength is what Moore says. You know, how can you let the lion know his strength? We were fine with him in a cage before, but now you're letting him out. And so, but each time he gives me a bit more strength and then pulls me back. And I think Anne does a very similar exercise until she marries me. Well, even after that.
My guests are Nathaniel Parker, King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall Parts 1 and 2, Lydia Leonard, who's Anne Boleyn, and Ben Miles, who plays Thomas Cromwell. It is at the Winter Garden Theater on Broadway between 50th and 51st Streets. And for ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Ben Miles, who plays Thomas Cromwell, Lydia Leonard, who plays Anne Boleyn, and Nathaniel Parker, who plays King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2, the Royal Shakespeare Company's production that's now at the Winter Garden Theater on Broadway between 5th and 51st Streets. And is this, I assume, a limited run?
It is.
We're scheduled to play till July the 5th.
Yes.
Originally did this in London.
Originally in Stratford upon Avon.
In Stratford, all the
same
cast.
In a theatre a third the size of where we are now, on stage volume, but also house volume, a third of the size we're in now.
All the same cast, yeah.
And how much of an adjustment was that? Did you have to re-rehearse?
For each venue, we did. Yeah, we re-rehearsed and we redeveloped parts of the script as well, which was exciting.
Because you fill the stage here, even though the stage is fairly bare.
It's huge.
Fill it with nothing, though. Isn't that brilliant? I mean, we don't have any scenery. We have a
chair,
interesting
that. Yeah, I was saying to someone last night. That's it.
But people are moving all the time.
There's a lot of motion.
There's dance and there are other things.
And we've built sort of into the auditorium, so there are these auditoriums so actors make entrances through the audience a bit.
Yeah, through the orchestra.
Really opens it up.
And that's only in this production?
Yep. We had that in Stratford, but then in London we couldn't have it because of the nature of the Cross Arch. Yeah. So it's really wonderful to be able to brought it back here.
This is like a great blend of the two venues we've played before. The Swan Theatre in Stratford-on-Avon, which is, as you say, you could involve the audience a lot more. The audience are kind of more involved in the show. And the Aldwych Theatre in London's West End, which was a very sort of... it was a classic sort of proscenium arch theatre. It was a very sort of visual show. There was the audience over there and the actors over here. But this is a fantastic blend of the two. I think it's the best venue we've ever had, myself.
Do you? Yes, yeah, I think it is.
And you follow Cats into that theatre.
Cats, Mamma Mia, West Side Story.
Similar.
Yeah.
I think the last serious play there was Othello.
Some,
the original production.
How involved was Hilary Mantel in this production?
In this production, she's a member of the company. She's there. She was there every single day of rehearsals.
From the very start Stratford?
In Stratford, she was there from the beginning, but she wasn't as hands-on as she is now. For the US production, she's been there every day.
Did she change things?
Yeah, for coming here, yes. We've lost about 10-15 minutes from each play.
Yeah, we have.
But we've added bits, so we've made it more accessible.
adjusted for an American audience that might not understand some of the nuances?
Not that might not understand. No. That's not the point at all. Just for the different stage and for getting things clearer.
It's constantly in evolution, this script. Mm. You know, that's been one of the most exciting things about working on it for me. We've been on this project more or less 2 years now. And the script is never locked down, as they say. It's never sort of... There were still versions flying around of scenes that
well, there was a version of a speech I did yesterday that I've never done before. Anyway, moving swiftly on.
That could get confusing. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
No, well, roughly the right words, but not necessarily in the right order.
But also you had the advantage of being able to ask her questions
That
about
was a
even
real
the
gift.
Most subtle things.
Yeah.
Did she give you surprising answers sometimes?
Yes, surprising in their scale and their depth. Mm. I remember very, very early on in rehearsals for Stratford, I emailed Hilary a question about what might be going through Cromwell's head before the first scene of Wolf Hall Part 1. He makes this journey from the north of England back down to London, which will take him about 2 weeks.
He'd gone up there to get money and then...
To try to get money from the monasteries in Yorkshire.
Come back with anything.
No. They politely told him to go away. Back came this answer from Hilary, which was like a chapter from the book. It was a sort of four-page email about what was going on in Cromwell's mind, what his thoughts were on the church, the state of the roads, how many horses he would have used, you know, the boots he was wearing, what was in his bag. And I was gobsmacked by it. And from that point on, we've all had this incredible portal into her mind, you know, and her imagination. And she's very willingly given back to us.
And it's fed her too. I think it's been wonderfully reciprocal, because she's at the same time now thinking for the next book. Oh, well, I'm sure she's looking at Anne and thinking, well, that's, you know, Lydia, is that focused? And then she's looking at Cromwell. And there's traits of ours that she's bringing in.
I'll be dead.
Ben, you'll be dead. You'll be dead.
You might be a ghost. Yeah.
Yeah,
just come back as a ghost, yeah.
you've called Hilary and Ben a proper little working couple.
Yeah.
Ben, in working with her, hasn't she credited you with helping her understand Cromwell better? She said, he solved certain problems for me, and she called you one of the shapers of the third Cromwell novel that she's still working on.
Well, if I have, it's a great honor for me, you know. She's intimated to me that seeing the shows, seeing us all perform has informed her about what she will write for the third book, and that's a fantastic feeling as a company, as an actor, to collaborate in that way with her.
Nat, in talking with her, did you ever get the feeling that she had more affection for Cromwell than she did for Henry VIII?
Oh, definitely. She's in love with Cromwell, I think. Definitely. But there are moments when she's come back to me, and I got, as a first night present in London, a little couple of paragraphs of the next book, because the day before... two days before, on a technical rehearsal, I was wearing my big final costume with a big chain across it, and I saw her, and she's only wee, you know, Hilary, and I gave her a big hug to say hello. I'm a big hugging kind of person. I gave her a big hug, and she came off with an imprint of the chain on her cheek. And so the moment she's written me the three paragraphs, when Henry meets Anne of Cleves, and he's looking at her thinking, oh, no, but I better give her a hug and show people that I'm willing. So he gives her a big hug, and such a long hug, some of the surrounding nobles are going, could we break him up quickly? She's dying. You know, but eventually she comes off, and she's got this big imprint of the chain on her cheek, and she's put it in there. So, yes, it is a thrill.
Well, talking about costumes, Lydia,
yes.
Although you're not on the in every scene, you make up for that with some of the most amazing costume changes. How many different gowns do you wear?
11. Which is...
And are the corsets as confining as they look? Are you finding it difficult to breathe?
Actually not. They're beautifully made by the team up in Stratford at the RSC. So they're not as uncomfortable as when you've worn corsets for things where they've been hired from a costume place or something. Some of the dresses are very heavy. Lucy Briarty, who plays Catherine, had a dress which I think has been adjusted now. But when we were in Stratford, weighed 2 stone, which is... Do you do stones?
How many pounds?
I think it's 14 pounds.
28 pounds, yeah.
28 pounds.
That's nothing.
14 pounds of stone.
So there were some back problems, particularly when we're on the rake stage. But no, they're overall just a pleasure to wear. They're absolutely beautiful. And they really chart, they do a lot of the work, because they chart the sort of rise in power and status for all of the characters, men and the women, as you sort of grow in favour with the king. You know, you have more money to buy more fabric, so the sleeves get more ornate. Or you talk to Henry and the men about the fashion for cod pieces at the time, which is quite extraordinary, but a brilliant kind of detail in the whole play.
But Cromwell doesn't have that problem, because you're pretty much on the stage all the time. Look like, at the end of a scene, you look like you're making an exit, Ben, and then the lights come up again, and there you are.
Someone else turns up. Right, I've got to act with you now. I do. My costumes do. I think I have three changes, but they're not huge changes, and they only happen on the rare occasion that I have a scene off.
What was the casting like here? Was it complicated, or since you've all had experiences with the Royal Shakespeare, were you kind of the people they expected from the start?
I've no idea what the background to the casting process was. Personally, myself, I know in script development, in kind of table reads of early drafts, other people were involved in reading Cromwell. But I just got a call out of the blue one day in October, saying they want you to play the part. So before that, I don't know what had happened.
And then we were talking about rehearsals. Mm. Although Hilary Mantel wasn't as involved in the early rehearsals, she has been since. So has that changed your sense of the characters that you're playing over the course of it?
Mm. I mean, I think the joy of being able to turn to Hilary and say, I can't quite get this line. It's just not settling in me. What do you think? She comes back. I've got one speech in the end of Bodies, part two, that is, Wolf Hall part two, which is now, as my director calls it, the greatest hits of four different speeches, which have happened at different times. And actually, that's quite hard to do sometimes, because the lines will just switch around, and I'll say a line, and if I'm not careful, I'll go back to what I said at the Aldwych in London, which is what I've just said in the previous line. So I've got to, oh, my goodness. But Hilary has somehow managed, I think, to get it absolutely right this time.
She gave us these extraordinary notes for every single character. There are maybe sort of two sides of A4 each, detailed character notes, which were invaluable. And you think, God, I wish I could have that every time you play a part. Mm. And also very useful for kind of quoting interviews and passing off as your own wise thoughts. To my horror, apparently they've been published. So
have they? I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, damn.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you do the two plays in sequence on Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah. And sometimes Monday, Wednesdays.
And then on Wednesdays, you do part two first and then part one in the evening, which must be rather confusing.
Not every week. Occasionally we do it.
It may even be more confusing. It
keeps you on your toes. I mean, I generally don't know what show we're doing next. When we finish show at night, there's a call that goes out around.
They just push you out there.
It's Bodies Part 1 tomorrow, and I go, right, Bodies Part 1.
It's easier. I mean, when I was a kid at the RSC and 25 years old, and I was doing six plays, you know, I would literally turn up in the dressing room, see which costume was hanging, and do that one.
Yeah. It's strange to have Masterpiece Theatre doing a six-part version of Wolf Hall at the same time that you're on Broadway, because people are coming to the theatre with a sense of the story. In your case, Ben, Cromwell is played by a very great actor, Mark Rylance, a friend of yours, I guess.
Yeah.
You're not Mark Rylance. You're doing your version of
it. No, it is strange. It's a strange coincidence that there are these two versions present in the U.S., at the moment. It wasn't originally intended to be aired at the same time as we came to Broadway, but it is. It has changed. It's odd. They're two extremely different versions of the stories, but they're both the best versions for their media.
Although there are a couple of lines that I remember from the television show.
Script
in the play.
Script-wise,
it's
pretty much identical.
All the best bits are from the same author.
Exactly. Yeah.
Although for us, for American audiences, it feels very simultaneous. But we did the play for so long in Stratford and finished the whole run in London before it then came out on the BBC. Which was not quite nice. It wasn't sort of. Doesn't feel quite so on top of each other for in terms of our creating the roles or
I, I think the BBC version was coming up while we were rehearsing in London, wasn't it?
Yeah, when we rehearsed for this.
You had to be careful not to watch it.
It's no coincidence it's happening at the same time. I think it was a ploy.
War fever.
And yeah. I think that's fine. You know, either way, it's got to be an advantage to both of us. So it's fine.
Lydia, didn't you live in France until you were five?
So does I was born in France. Yeah, I was quite small when we came back.
Well, you're playing a French character here.
Well, she's not French. She's English, but yeah, she'd spent a long time in the French court. In fact, because in the book, she talks with a slight French accent, but it's sort of an affectation, Hilary said. But it was a bit confusing. I don't do that anymore for the whole. I mean, for the
bulk
of...
You do say Cromwell.
Which is a detail from the book. But it's a bit confusing to have done that just because people then start thinking she's French, and she's not. She was an English girl. She's from Kent. But she'd spent a long time in France.
Yeah.
And Ben, is it true that you pursued acting in school productions primarily because it allowed you to miss classes?
I'll neither confirm nor deny that.
School that bad?
School was great, actually. It was a great school. We had this amazing theatre, this purpose-built theatre in the round, which was a great draw to people who were, you know, had interests other than what was on the curriculum. You know, it was a great environment for creativity.
And Nat, you graduated as the star pupil of the year from the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
No, I did not. The opposite, in fact. The opposite. I don't know where that comes from. I hope that's my PR team. That's great.
That's your publicist.
But you were in the audience.
I was in the audience, you're right, in London with Helen.
And did you have to choose between...
I did, and there's no choice. I mean, Gordon Brown is a lovely character to play, but compared to Henry, there's no choice
you're
at
Henry
all.
Henry VIII. Yeah.
But I think I was the only student in my year at Lambda who didn't get a prize. Oh. So I think I was the reverse of the star.
Oh, that's what I...
We've got to get one.
Just one more thing before you go. You're here in New York, and we have two incredible Holbeins at the Frick.
Yeah.
Portraits of Cromwell and Moore, Thomas Moore. Have you gone by to see them?
We have. The first day we arrived, literally after we landed, the next day we were invited very kindly by the Frick to come and view them and look round and had a wonderful talk.
Does it bother you that the Moor is a much better painting than the Crown?
I'll let him have that. I'll let him have that glory. I don't need that kind of publicity.
Thank you all so much for being on our show. Ben Miles plays Thomas Cromwell, Lydia Leonard, Anne Boleyn, and Nathaniel Parker, King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2. The Royal Shakespeare Company's production that's now at the Winter Garden Theater on Broadway between 5th and 51st Streets. For ticket details, go to our show page at WNYC.org.